Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, July 24th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, City Council Votes to Pursue Bond Fix for Firefighters' Pension, by Trevor Hawes, Editorial Director. Midland City Council members have made a tough decision to help shore up the firefighters' pension shortfall. Now, it's up to the firefighters to weigh in. On Tuesday, council members voted unanimously to approve a resolution authorizing the execution of a pension obligation bond agreement with the Midland Firemen's Relief and Retirement Fund. If the bond makes it to the November ballot, the deadline of which is August 19th, the amount will be between $60 million and $61 million. Time is ticking to address the $120 million unfunded liability with the pension fund. The city will be accountable if the fund runs out of money, Mayor Lori Blong said during Tuesday's city council meeting. She added that no one currently on council caused the problem that the city, firefighters, and taxpayers see themselves in. We're basically only left with negative solutions. A presentation by the city noted six key findings from the Texas Pension Review Board in 2021 about the issues facing the pension fund, which included a lack of fundamental governance practices, transparency and accuracy of concerns, investments underperforming assumptions, high investment expenses, poor asset allocation fit, significant risk of fund exhaustion. Ultimately, the PRB recommended that the fund and the city balance increased contributions and benefit reductions to improve funding. The presentation also laid out a slew of actuarial recommendations over the years that were ignored by the Pension Review Board, including cost of living calculation changes, reducing surviving spouse payments, and increasing the retirement age from 50 to 51, among many others. Pension Fund Board Chairman Justin Graham, speaking with the Reporter Telegram on Monday before the meeting, says much of the problem goes back to 2010 when the city issued a hiring freeze for firefighters. The amount a firefighter receives from the pension is the average of their highest paying 60 months. Graham says the hiring freeze led to lots of overtime, which boosted highest average pay very high. Some retirees were 110% of their salary when they retired, he said. But we had to have overtime so stations wouldn't be browned out. In 2018, the pension board found that overtime was the problem. Graham added that the city's proposal is not ready for signature yet. The board hasn't had a chance to agree to anything. Passing a bond is not the only part of the solution being proposed by the city. Firefighters will have to agree to benefit cuts of 5% or more, and that an actuarially determined contribution, ADC rate, be installed to ensure the fund stays solvent for years to come. The ADC ratio would be 2-1, meaning that when the contribution needs to be adjusted, the city will provide 2/3 of the money and the firefighters will provide 1/3. The pension fix proposal now goes to the pension board. Ultimately, and by state law, the firefighters will decide whether the proposal will go forward. This article is entitled 4.9 Magnitude Earthquake Shakes Up Hermley, by Mella McEwen, Oil Editor. A series of earthquakes struck about 11 miles northeast of Hermley in Scurry County, beginning with a 4.9 magnitude earthquake that struck about 10:38 p.m. Monday evening. The earthquake could be felt as far east as Dallas-Fort Worth. That was followed by a 2.8 magnitude earthquake and a 4.4 magnitude earthquake about 10:46 p.m. and a 3.1 magnitude earthquake close to midnight. A 3 magnitude earthquake was also felt about 7:39 a.m. Tuesday morning. Across the Permian Basin, there has been an increase in the rate of earthquakes felt at the surface, said Dr. Peter Hennings, principal investigator for the Center for Integrated Seismicity Research, CISR, at the University of Texas's Bureau of Economic Geology. Speaking with the Reporter-Telegram by phone, Hennings said those occurrences have been definitely linked to the injection of produced water. Subsurface injection of produced water, especially deeper beneath the shales, causes pore pressure increases that, combined with existing faults, can cause a rupture and cause an increase. If the fault ruptures more abruptly and over a larger region, it can cause earthquakes, like the 4.9 magnitude earthquake last night, he said. CISR, the BEG, and the TexNet Seismic Monitoring Network, BEG overseas, has studied the eastern side of the Permian, where the recent earthquakes occurred, and found growing seismic activity rates and magnitudes, Hennings continued. There are also other regions, like the Culberson-Reeves County line, where the Railroad Commission, working with operators, reduced injection rates, resulting in a decline in seismicity. Similarly, the Commission worked with operators in the Midland-Odessa area to reduce injection rates, also resulting in a decline in seismicity. We are looking into the Hermley earthquakes, and the Railroad Commission is looking into them, Hennings said. I urge people who reported the earthquakes to contact us again later to see how we responded. This article is entitled Jail Escapee Found, from the Midland Reporter-Telegram. A man who escaped from jail has been found. At about 9:30 p.m. Monday, Adolfo Williams escaped from the Minimal Security Housing Unit of Central Detention, according to a news release from the Midland County Sheriff's Office. He was located by deputies and other law enforcement at about 1 a.m. in the 1500 block of West Griffin Avenue and taken back into custody. According to jail records, Williams was arrested July 20th for violation of probation and possession of a controlled substance. He was booked again Monday, this time for felony escape. This article is entitled Midland Health Services Starts Wastewater Surveillance for COVID-19 by Kesley Salinas, staff writer. The Midland Health Services Department recently started a wastewater surveillance program with the Texas Department of State Health Services to monitor for COVID-19 and other pathogens in the community. Tyler Collins, epidemiologist at Midland Health Services, said that this will allow them to track how widespread diseases such as COVID-19, influenza, flu, respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, and norovirus, a type of stomach bug, are in the community. The health department has partnered with local wastewater treatment plants to help them collect samples for testing and surveillance. Back in March, the state's health department removed COVID-19 from the list of notifiable conditions. Before that, local health providers were required to report all the COVID-19 tests that were taken by Midland residents to the Midland Health Department. We don't get those reports anymore, Collins said. The things we look at are hospitalization data and the Texas Respiratory Illness Interactive Dashboard. It tracks cases of COVID, the flu, and RSV through hospital admissions, emergency department visits, and splits it by ages and regions. According to the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, people with certain infections can shed pieces of the virus or bacteria when they use the bathroom, shower, wash their hands, or do laundry, even if they don't have any symptoms. The pieces of the virus or bacteria travel into the sewage system through toilets, sinks, showers, and other drains. Before the wastewater is treated, operators can collect samples to send to laboratories to test for different infections circulating. Wastewater surveillance monitors for pathogens through systemic sampling, processing, and analysis of wastewater data to detect the genetic material of targeted pathogens. The testing information is available in 5 to 7 days after waste enters the sewer. According to the Texas Department of State Health Services, wastewater surveillance is more effective than relying on reported cases of diseases because the sampling can detect pathogens in the community regardless of an individual's symptoms. Collins said that the wastewater testing surveillance in Midland is in its preliminary testing period, but expects it to help track the level of viruses in the future. Before the data becomes usable, we have to establish a baseline in the community, Collins said. We expect to establish a baseline for around 3 months before the data becomes usable. Right now, it's too small of a sample size, which is why this period is important. Collins added that many cities in the state are heading in the direction of wastewater surveillance because it is low cost and because people can stay anonymous through the collection. Midland Health Services will be able to participate in the wastewater surveillance program at no cost. Collins said that the State Department is providing full funding for this program. We're excited to have this data, Collins said. It's a really helpful way to know what's going on in the community at no additional cost. Collins added that Midland is seeing an upward trend of COVID-19 cases. He said that because we are a little further from the Texas metros, we lagged them by a couple of weeks. We are still on the lower end of the peak than other parts of the state, Collins said. However, we do expect cases to increase as the month goes by. The Midland Health Department suggests following the CDC guidelines for COVID-19, which are to stay home if you are feeling sick and returning to normal activities if the symptoms improve, and at least 24 hours after a fever, if present, break. While the Midland Health Services doesn't provide testing services, they are able to provide vaccines for COVID-19. For more information about Midland Health Services, visit their website. This article is entitled, PSP Leverages $153 Million into $1.5 Billion in Investments, by Mella McEwen, Oil Editor. Since 2019, the member companies of the Permian Strategic Partnership and the additional companies that bring membership to 30 have committed $153 million to investments in education, healthcare, workforce development, and road safety initiatives. According to the coalition's annual report for 2023, that $153 million has been parlayed into over $1.5 billion in collaborative investments. Those collaborative investments have resulted in everything from a new career technical education high school in Hobbs, New Mexico, and Harmony Public Schools' new Science Academy in Midland, to the Permian Basin Behavioral Health Center, now under construction. The last 5 years have been incredibly inspiring and humbling for the PSP. Our work with federal, state, local, and private partners through public-private partnerships has proven to be a successful model, and we are excited for the work ahead. Our region deserves the very best in education, healthcare, roads, and workforce development opportunities. The past 5 years have shown that big ideas can become reality if we all work together. The vision and leadership of the members of PSP is truly special, I am so thankful for their dedication to our region. Tracy Bentley, President and Chief Executive Officer of PSP, commented to the Reporter Telegram by email. Over the past 5 years, through public-private partnership, PSP has helped fund 8 surgery and subspecialty fellowships per year, 10 family medicine residents per year, equip 134 elementary schools with STEM centers, helped 264 veterans connect with Permian Basin veterans, and donated over 8,500 pieces of equipment to first responders. Since its founding, the PSP has served as a philanthropic model for industries seeking to make impactful and lasting investments in their communities. Through effective public-private partnerships, the PSP has successfully enhanced the quality of life for residents in the Permian Basin, spanning 22 counties in West Texas and southeastern New Mexico. The PSP's notable investments have been dedicated to addressing critical needs in the region, including $65,100,000 in education investments impacting hundreds of thousands of students, $58,700,000 in health care investments to strengthen and expand access for the region's 2 million residents, $7,800,000 in critical road safety initiatives, programs, and life-saving equipment, $13,900,000 in workforce development to train and upskill the region's current workforce. PSP's 30 members are Apache Corporation, BPX Energy, Champion X, Chevron, Civitas Resources, ConocoPhillips, Coterra Energy, Devon Energy, Diamondback Energy, Endeavor Energy Resources, Energy Transfer, EOG Resources, ExxonMobil, Halliburton, Helmerich & Payne, Kinetic, Liberty Energy, Mewbourne Oil Company, Occidental, Ovintiv, Permian Resources, Phillips 66, Plains All American, ProPetro, SLB, Targa Resources, the Texas Tech University System, the University of Texas System, Waterbridge Resources, and Western Midstream. This article is entitled, Water Woes Deepen. Court cases, drier weather could hinder city's water deal. By Trevor Hawes, Editorial Director. Potable water is a perpetual issue in Midland. While the tall city has found another source out west that could provide water for decades to come, it's possible the work might be for naught because of litigation that has already reached the Texas Supreme Court, as well as climate issues. On Tuesday, City Council voted unanimously to execute a memorandum of understanding with the cities of Abilene and San Angelo to build an infrastructure system to bring water from Fort Stockton Holdings to these three cities. In 2020, Midland inked a deal with Fort Stockton Holdings, which is owned by the Clayton Williams family, to buy 28,400 acre-feet of groundwater annually. Midland would retain 15,000 acre-feet, Abilene would get 8,400 acre-feet, and San Angelo would take 5,000 acre-feet. In a media event held Friday at the city's water plant, Mayor Lori Blong and Councilman Jack Ladd and Eric Davidson touted the deal. "This is an exciting project," Davidson said. "This will allow Midland to have a fully sustainable water future." Added Ladd, "It's a comprehensive regional solution to a 100-year water problem. This will make Midland water independent." The prominent Cockrell family and its Belding Farms have their concerns, and challenges. It seems silly to me for a city, charged with investing the money of its citizens, that it's going to spend money on a permit faced with 5 legal challenges. Ryan Reed, outside legal counsel for the Cockrell family and Belding Farms, told the Reporter-Telegram after Tuesday's council meeting. The Cockrell family operates a 2,200-acre pecan orchard that abuts Fort Stockton Holdings land. It currently has 5 lawsuits, 2 of which have reached the Texas Supreme Court, against its neighbors and the Midland-Pecos Groundwater Conservation District, which manages groundwater in the area. Groundwater rights in Fort Stockton have been fraught with litigation for many decades. Fort Stockton sits above the Edwards Trinity Aquifer, a large part of which the city of Fort Stockton relies on for its own water source, but from which Fort Stockton Holdings wants to pump and sell to Midland, Abilene, and San Angelo. Reed said Fort Stockton Holdings is currently permitted to pump about 50,000 acre-feet, but historically has only ever used 30,000 acre-feet, all of it for its farm operations. To sell 28,000 acre-feet, it will have to reduce its farm use to 20,000 acre-feet and will pump its maximum allowed. The Cockrells are concerned about what will happen to the aquifer if that much is taken. The Cockrells are challenging Fort Stockton Holdings permit in 5 lawsuits, the oldest of which dates to 2017. Reed explained that the first case challenges the settlement agreement between Fort Stockton Holdings and the Conservation District. The second challenges the permit's renewal. Both are currently before the state Supreme Court. A third case that challenges the renewal is before the El Paso Court of Appeals. The 4th and 5th, also targeting the permit, are in their infancy, Reed said. While true that the aquifer recharges, there is a complete misunderstanding of the recharge and rules that apply with respect to the permit, assuming it's valid, Reed said. There is a huge lack of science as to this aquifer as it draws down. Without having solid science to understand what happens to the aquifers as they decline, I think the cities are foolish to build infrastructure to move water. Permits aren't the only issue. A 2018 study found that the dry line, a springtime meteorological phenomenon that causes dry weather to the west and wet, severe weather to the east, has moved 140 miles to the east. On July 17th, David Munyon, meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in Midland, told the Reporter-Telegram for a separate story that he has observed the dry line shift and that the change means less rain will fall in Midland, Odessa, and areas to the west, like Fort Stockton, in the future. Carlos Rubenstein, a water policy consultant for the Cockrell family, said the dry line shift is absolutely true, and that during the last Texas legislative session, the legislature asked and authorized regional planning groups to plan for more severe droughts. It's a concern and a fact, he said. Reed added that exactly from where the Edwards Trinity Aquifer recharges is still not well known. Its reliability as a 100-year source remains to be seen. The modeling that has been done just assumes there will be a foot of recharge a year, he said. It doesn't really rain that much in the desert. This conservation district is paying people to try and seed rain clouds. If you're that desperate for rain, you're not getting enough rain to recharge the aquifer. The groundwater district allots $10,000 in its budget for cloud seeding. The Reporter-Telegram asked Blong at the media event about the pending change in weather. She said all involved in the deal have consulted multiple experts and that they have confidence in their opinions. As for the Cockrell's pecan orchard, Reed and Rubenstein said Belding Farms is fortunate to sit on a good aquifer. However, the city of Fort Stockton often struggles. Water in this case is not about the pecan, Rubenstein said. It's about the socioeconomic impacts to the area. There's a human impact. This is the Life Tributes column. Susan Mastin, February 22, 1953 to July 15, 2024. Susan Fleming Mastin walked into the open arms of her Heavenly Father on July 15, 2024. Susie was born on February 22, 1953 in New Rochelle, New York, to Martha and Robert Gleason. She was raised in Midland, where she attended Midland High School, graduating in 1971. Susie is preceded in death by her parents, Martha Wallingford Gleason and Robert Ellis Gleason, and her brother, Thomas Gleason. She is survived and will be immeasurably missed by her brother, Michael Gleason, her son, Nick, her daughter, Jenny, and her husband, Dan Harris, and her two treasured grandsons, James and Scotty Harris. Family and friends are invited to celebrate Susie's life at First Presbyterian Church in Midland at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Thursday, July 25th. Please wear colors of your choosing to celebrate a tremendously bright spirit that is our loss, but heaven's gain. In lieu of customary remembrances, the family requests memorial donations be made to the ASPCA in her name. Mary B. Coro, August 24, 1930 to June 6, 2024. Mary B. Coro passed on to God's presence on June 6, 2024 at the age of 93 in Odessa. She is survived by her sister, Virginia Chasey of Rancho Santa Fe, California. Mary leaves behind six grateful children and their spouses, John and Wanine Marks of Vaughan, Washington, Gail and Brandon Spear of Overland Park, Kansas, Wayne Marks of Pflugerville, Texas, Mary T. Buck Mathis of Midland, Barry and Nancy Marks of Odessa, and Susan and Todd Rognes of Clear Lake, Iowa. Grandma Nana was tremendously proud of her 15 grandchildren and 23 great-grandchildren. Mary Coro was preceded in death by her husbands, Don Coro and John Marks, her brothers, Henry Boris and Ronnie Boris, and her parents, Henry Boris and Mary Mikowicz Boris. A memorial service will be held at 9:15 a.m. on August 8th at Sunset Funeral Home Northeast, located at 4631 Hondo Pass in El Paso, followed by a ceremony at Fort Bliss National Cemetery at 10:30 a.m., followed by a lunch celebration for all who are able to attend. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the El Paso Flag Site. Kenneth Steward, July 2, 1935 to July 2, 2024. Kingsland. Kenneth Allen Steward passed away on July 21, 2024. A graveside service will be held on July 26, 2024 at 10:30 a.m. at Lakeland Hills Memorial Park in Burnet, Texas. Anne Hewitt Schwining. Anne Hewitt Schwining, 77, of Midland, passed away July 20th. The family will receive guests from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Friday, August 2nd at Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 11:30 a.m. Saturday, August 3rd at First Christian Church in Midland, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
Interventional strategies, a key to pain management. When people have joint or spine pain, they'll likely come to MCH ProCare Interventional Pain Medicine. They start with a physical exam to see how bad the joint is. X-rays will be taken and some MRIs are given. If the X-ray doesn't show a lot going on and the patient is still in pain, then we know that some ligaments are involved. Most patients come in with joint pain, spine pain, and pain that they've had for a while. Pain management is a model of intervention. It's not just treating pain with medication. We treat pain with procedures to relieve the pain. How they intervene depends on the patient. If it's beyond intervention, it will likely mean surgery. Many times, though, corticosteroid injections work and patients come back feeling a lot better. Another treatment is platelet-rich plasma, where they take blood from the patient, put it in a spinner that will spin it and generate a lot of platelets. The platelets are put back into the knee, and that helps the healing process of the knee. If the cartilage is gone and there is no healing, surgery is next on the list. There are more therapies now than there used to be that are non-invasive. The platelet-rich plasma can be done for knees, backs, and shoulders. Along with knees, they can also treat the lumbar spine and the cervical spine. Common causes for knee pain or arthritis is the degeneration of the cartilage between the knees. Some people tear the meniscus. Too much playing, too much exercise. That's most of the stuff that they see with the knees. Some people have fractures, and those are the ones we need to send to orthopedics. People of all ages can suffer with joint problems. Kids who play contact sports and sports with repetitive motion can suffer a torn meniscus and ACLs. A lot of people expect to come in to the MCH Pro intervention to get a prescription for pain medication. And if they wrote pain medication for everybody that came through, they would have a line from here to Midland. We have to always educate our patients. We are interventional pain management. Most people don't understand that they are not here to write the pain medications people want. They treat the pain while giving them medication and then titrate them off it. According to Oxford Academic, opioid titration is the process whereby the dose of opioid analgesic is altered until the minimum dose, which controls an individual pain, is reached or intolerable toxicity develops. Once they treat the pain, their intention is not to keep patients on narcotics for the rest of their lives, because narcotics can be addictive. We look for the root of the pain. The major thing that we do here is the intervention. We find what the problem is and we fix it, so the patient doesn't need the medication. But we give you medication as we are fixing it because we know you're in pain. We also encourage people to do physical therapy too, because the physical therapy has to fix the pain. When we've done all of that and you're feeling better, we will gradually titrate the patient off the medication. Patients are told when they go to pain management that they can't be on marijuana or cocaine. Most of them get angry because in other states it is allowed. They can take it and take their narcotics. Unfortunately, if you have to be on narcotics from this office, you cannot take those. We do drug tests. Patients have to sign a narcotic agreement where the patient won't doctor shop for opioids. There is a prescription drug monitoring program, so when a patient is looking for pain medication, the doctor can tell they have already gotten it elsewhere. When they sign a narcotic agreement with us, they're not going to do that. If they do it, that's a breach of the contract, and we have the right to stop seeing them. We let them know up front that you can do this. We're going to drug test you. They also test for other substances. If we see other substances, that's also grounds for terminations, but most of the patients are compliant. They understand what it is. They want their pain to be fixed, so they follow the rules and everything goes well. This day in history, Today is Wednesday, July the 24th, and on July the 24th in 1969, the Apollo 11 astronauts, two of whom had been the first humans to set foot on the moon, splashed down safely in the Pacific. Also on this date, in 1567, Mary, Queen of Scots, was forced to abdicate her throne to her one-year-old son, James. In 1866, Tennessee became the first state to be readmitted to the Union after the Civil War. In 1915, the SS Eastland, a passenger ship carrying more than 2,500 people, rolled onto its side while docked at the Clark Street Bridge on the Chicago River. An estimated 844 people died in the disaster. In 1932, the Bonus Army, a group of thousands of WW1 veterans and their supporters who gathered in Washington, D.C. to protest the U.S. government's refusal to redeem cash bonus certificates given to the veterans for their service, clashed with D.C. police. Two protesting veterans were shot and killed. In 1959, during a visit to Moscow, Vice President Richard Nixon engaged in his famous kitchen debate with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. In 1974, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled that President Richard Nixon had to turn over subpoenaed White House tape recordings to the Watergate special prosecutor. In 1975, an Apollo spacecraft splashed down in the Pacific, completing a mission which included the first docking with a Soyuz capsule from the Soviet Union. In 2010, a stampede inside a tunnel crowded with techno music fans left 21 people dead and more than 500 injured at the famed Love Parade Festival in Western Germany. In 2013, a high-speed train crash outside Santiago de Compostela in northwest Spain killed 79 people. Tipicop events benefit Special Olympics in Texas. As Special Olympics Texas races into the final heats of summer sports, Midland and Odessa's Texas Roadhouse restaurants team up with local police to raise money for the statewide organization. The fundraiser is part of a statewide effort with dozens of other Texas Roadhouse locations holding fundraisers the same week. Police officers will help serve guests at the Tip a Cop event and collect donations. Over the past 15 years, Texas Roadhouse restaurants across the state have raised more than $1,984,600 at this event for Special Olympics. Texas Roadhouse has a continuous history of giving back to its communities. In this case, 100% of all donations will go directly to Special Olympics Texas. Participating locations are at 4221 Grandview Avenue in Odessa and 4512 West Loop 250 North in Midland. How do I pay my Medicare premium monthly? By Tony King. Dear Tony, my Medicare began June the 1st, and I received my first bill about a week ago. This bill is for 4 months, from June 1st to September the 30th, and is over $700. I thought Medicare was monthly. If I pay this amount due on June the 25th, then I cannot pay my rent for August. I was wondering if Medicare allows payments for Medicare Part B premiums to be monthly. I can't start my Social Security check because I am not at my full retirement age. I work and pay more than Social Security allows without having to pay a penalty. Tony answers, you are correct that many Americans are paying their Medicare premiums monthly through Social Security automatically, taking the Medicare premium from their Social Security check. Social Security will send a letter informing the Medicare beneficiary that it is deducting the monthly Medicare Part B premiums from their Social Security check. But since you are not yet receiving your Social Security check, Julie, search the phrase Medicare Easy Pay online to learn how to pay your Medicare premiums monthly from your checking account, or visit Medicare.gov, where you can research many topics, including how to download and properly set up Medicare Easy Pay. For readers who do not have access to a computer, call 800-MEDICARE. That's 800-633-4227 and request the Medicare Easy Pay form to be sent to you by mail. Another option is to talk with a family member or friend that has access to a computer and ask them to assist you in downloading the Medicare Easy Pay form. It may take about 6 to 8 weeks to have the Medicare Easy Pay form to be processed. You should make sure that you keep up with your monthly premiums so your Medicare Parts A and B are not terminated. Until the Easy Pay form is activated, a simple way to pay either a monthly premium or your whole Medicare premium bill by credit card is by visiting Medicare.gov and creating a Medicare account. When creating a Medicare account, you must have applied for Medicare and have your Medicare number to open your account. On your Medicare account is your Medicare information, such as what Medicare Part D prescription drug plan or Medicare Advantage plan you are enrolled in, what your Medicare Part A and B enrollment dates are, what you can view, such as paying your Medicare premium, Medicare claims, printing your Medicare card, and much more. Also visit tinyurl.com/SE4HHZD3 after opening a Medicare.gov account. I would advise you and everyone on Medicare to stay current with your Medicare premium. By not staying current, Medicare beneficiaries can lose their benefits and may be charged a penalty when they re-enroll. Medicare Part D prescription drug premiums are not available via the Medicare site, but are managed by the Medicare Part D prescription drug company. Medicare beneficiaries can pay their Medicare prescription drug premium either directly to the prescription drug company by check or credit card. Many people do not realize that they can pay their Part B premiums monthly when not receiving their Social Security check by following the rules set up by Medicare. Take your time and study this Medicare rule. Visit Medicare.gov to open a Medicare account. Chapter 1 of Tony's Medicare Survival Guide, Advanced Edition, explains how to enroll in Medicare properly and receive your Medicare number to open up a Medicare.gov account by whether turning 65 or past 65 and still working. Tony's Medicare Survival Guide, Advanced Edition, is available at tonisays.com. Or call 832-519-8664 for Medicare help. Tony's Medicare Moments articles have just been released at familytalktoday.com/Medicare-moments. Obituaries: James Lee Jimmy Cameron, age 81, passed away on Friday, July 19th, at his home in Odessa. A celebration of Jim's life will be held at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home on Thursday, July the 25th, at 10 a.m. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home in Odessa. Mary B. Coro, age 93, passed away on June the 6th. A memorial service will be held at 9:15 a.m. on August the 8th at Sunset Funeral Home, Northeast, located at 4631 Hondo Pass in El Paso, followed by a ceremony at Fort Bliss National Cemetery at 10:30 a.m., followed by a lunch celebration for all who are able to attend. Barbara Sue Hibbs Waddell. A celebration of life will be held on August the 3rd, 2024 at 11 a.m. at First Baptist Church in Kermit, Texas. Arrangements are entrusted to Family Services Funeral Parlor. Margaret Joan Sinclair Ward, age 94, of Odessa, died Thursday, July the 18th in Odessa. Graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. July the 26th at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Stefan Fuchs, age 73, passed away on July the 15th in his home in Odessa. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Jimmy Nell Holcomb Parker, age 95, passed away on July the 19th in Cedar Park, Texas. The viewing will be Thursday, July the 25th from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Graveside services are Friday, July the 26th at 10 a.m. at Sunset Memorial Gardens in Odessa. Sandra Overton Foy passed away on July the 11th. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home in Odessa.
Country star Kane Brown to headline Lee County Fair and Rodeo Concert Series. July 23, 2024, by staff report. Country star Kane Brown will headline the upcoming 88th Annual Lee County Fair and PRCA Rodeo, which runs from August 2nd through the 10th at the Lee County Fairgrounds in Loving, New Mexico. The country artist began his hit songs, Heaven, What Ifs, Homesick, Good As You, and many more, will close out the fair with his In the Air tour Saturday, August 10th. Kicking off the concert series on Tuesday, August 6th, are the Bellamy Brothers, followed by Casting Crows on Wednesday, August 7th, Jody Messina on Thursday, August 8th, and Justin Moore on Friday, August 9th. Concerts will begin at 9:30 p.m. upon the conclusion of the rodeo action. The theme of this year's Lee County Fair and PRCA Rodeo is 88 Years of Tradition. In addition to the PRCA Rodeo and Concert Series, the fair will also feature arts and crafts, a carnival, extreme bulls event, livestock shows, commercial vendors, and some of the best fair food in the area. Gate admission is free on the first Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Wednesday all day, and free every day until 5 p.m. Beyond that, it is $10 for entrants ages 13 and over, $5 for children 6 through 12, and free for children 5 and under. No lawn chairs are allowed in the gate. Tickets may be purchased online at www.leecountyfair.net or at the box office the day of the event. This is Christy, and I'll be reading Midland Times. Commemorating Jim Hall's birthday, recognizing the journey of the driver and team owner, July 23, 2024. On July 23, 1935, in Abilene, Texas, James Ellis Hall was born. Raised in Colorado and New Mexico, he studied engineering at the California Institute of Technology, turning to racing when a promised job at General Motors fell through. Teaming up with his brother Dick at Carroll Shelby Sports Cars, Hall's driving prowess quickly gained recognition. At the 1960 United States Grand Prix, he caught attention with a surprising run in a Lotus Climax. In 1962 in Midland, Texas, Hall began building the first true chaparral, a pioneer sports racer with a composite monocoque chassis. His innovations in aerodynamics, torsional rigidity, and ground effects revolutionized race car design. Hall's cars dominated various series, including USRRC, Can-Am, Trans-Am, Formula 5000, and the Indianapolis 500. His 1965 Sebring win, facing formidable factory-backed Ford GTs and Ferraris, stood out. In 1966, the Chaparral 2E featured movable aerodynamic devices, notably a massive articulated wing. The 2J, introduced in 1970, incorporated a suction ground effect. Despite its dominance, it faced controversy and was eventually banned. Hall's driving career faced a premature end in 1968 after a crash, but his impact continued. Transitioning to team management, Hall, along with Carl Haas, formed Haas Hall Racing. Success followed in Formula 5000 and Can-Am with seven consecutive titles from 1974 to 1980. In 1978, they achieved IndyCar Racing's Triple Crown. The Chaparral 2K, known as the Yellow Submarine, marked Hall's return to car building and won the 1980 CART PPG IndyCar World Series. Hall retired in 1996, leaving an enduring legacy in racing innovation. The Permian Basin Petroleum Museum in Midland showcases his achievements, while awards and inductions highlight his impact on motorsports. Commemorating another year, Susan Graham, distinguished opera singer. On July 23, 1960, Susan Graham was born in Roswell, New Mexico. Raised in Midland, Texas, she honed her musical prowess, studying piano for 13 years and earning degrees from Texas Tech University and the Manhattan School of Music. A standout at the Metropolitan Opera's National Council auditions, Graham's talent reached global heights with her 1994 Covent Garden debut in Massenet's Cherubin. Noteworthy for premiering roles in contemporary operas like Harbison's The Great Gatsby and Hedgie's Dead Man Walking. She is also celebrated for championing French songs and contemporary American compositions. Graham's career milestones include singing at George W. Bush's inauguration and Edward M. Kennedy's televised funeral mass. A UNESCO delegate, she received accolades like the Chevalier of the Order of Arts and Letters and a Grammy. In 2006, Midland, Texas dedicated the first Susan Graham Day, a fitting tribute to a hometown artist whose impact transcends borders. From her operatic triumphs to diverse recordings, Susan Graham's journey is a testament to her enduring musical legacy. Celebrating Woody Harrelson's birthday, acknowledging the contributions of the actor, July 23, 2024. Woodrow Tracy Harrelson entered the world on July 23, 1961 in Midland, Texas. His birth against the backdrop of the scorching Texan summer marked the beginning of a life destined for the spotlight. Born to Secretary Diane and convicted hitman Charles Void Harrelson, Woodrow's early years were defined by adversity. His father's absence loomed large, having been incarcerated for the 1979 killing of federal judge John H. Wood, Jr. Raised in a Presbyterian household with his two brothers, Jordan and Brett, Harrelson's family faced financial hardships, relying on his mother's meager wages. The connection between Harrelson and Midland was etched in the dry, arid landscapes of his birthplace, yet it was his journey beyond the dusty Texas town that would leave an indelible mark. Harrelson's ascent to fame began with his role as bartender Woody Boyd on the NBC sitcom Cheers, a role that earned him accolades and set the stage for a prolific acting career. From acclaimed films like The People vs. Larry Flint to No Country for Old Men, Harrelson's versatility shone through. His Midland roots became a distant echo as Harrelson graced the screens, earning Emmy Awards and Academy nominations. The dusty Texan town witnessed the birth of an actor whose career spanned iconic roles, from the Hunger Games series to the dark comedy of Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Harrelson's journey, though far from the oil fields of Midland, remains intertwined with the place of its origin, a testament to the enduring influences of one's roots.
Dear Dr. Roach, in December 2023, I had an open heart aortic valve replacement. All went well, but then I contracted a staph infection. I had to have a second procedure to remove the top four sternal wires, leaving me with a baseball-sized wound that required a vacuum drain and antibiotics. During my treatment course, my infectious disease doctor informed me that there was another bacterium found that was unidentifiable and sent out of province to find out what it was. It turned out to be Mycobacterium cosmeticus, for which there are no known antibiotics to fight it, as it is very rare. With this new information, I had all the sternum wires removed, which required a third procedure. My vacuum drain was removed, and I am now being treated with wound dressings. I was again noted to have a staph infection, and I am now starting my second round of cefazolin today. But still, there were no antibiotics found to kill the Mycobacterium. My question is, why am I not dead? If it won't kill me, there surely must be some kind of symptoms to expect. No one can answer these questions. Dr. Roach answers, infectious complications, such as a wound infection after an open-heart surgery, are not rare. Staphylococcus aureus is a frequent culprit, and sulfasalazine is an excellent treatment. Proper wound care and antibiotics are the mainstays of treatment. First, it is not true that there aren't any antibiotics to treat this. A rare case of a lung infection from M. cosmeticus was successfully treated with a combination of four medicines that are commonly used to treat tuberculosis. Second, not all infections, especially not all skin infections, need to be treated with antibiotics. Abscesses are commonly treated by draining them. Although we often use antibiotics, drainage is the key part of treatment, and these usually heal without antibiotics. It's useful to remember that before antibiotics were discovered in the early 20th century, most people were successfully cured of infections with wound care and supportive measures. Now that some bacteria have become resistant to all antibiotics, we occasionally need to rely once again on the surgical techniques that have been used to treat serious infections for centuries. And you can write to Dr. Keith Roach at P.O. Box 536475, Orlando, Florida 32853-6475.
This is the Dear Abby column. Room assignments unclear for visiting Thruple. Dear Abby, my 25-year-old son lives with his two girlfriends, who are also romantically involved with each other. They share a single bedroom. One of them has a baby due this week, and the other has made noises about wanting a child. I don't approve of this arrangement, and I can't see it ending well. I love my son, and I have a good relationship with all three of them, but it flies in the face of my upbringing and beliefs. My question, how do I deal with this threesome if they come to stay at my house? I don't want this going on under my roof, but I don't know how to assign bedrooms. If it were just two of them in a committed relationship, I could suck it up and put them together. But all three? I think my son knows me well enough to hopefully make that decision before coming here. I'm afraid if I assign bedrooms according to my convictions, it will lead to a falling out. Any advice? Signed, Conflicted Dad in Ohio. Dear Dad, discuss your feelings with your son as soon as he tells you he and his extended family want to stay at your home. Explain that what goes on in his dwelling is his business, but in your home you prefer the three of them, or four once the baby arrives, not to share one room, and let him decide where everyone sleeps. This would include staying in a nearby hotel or motel during their visit, which might be more comfortable for them. Dear Abby, after 40 years, I just started talking to my daughter again. I explained why I hadn't been in her life, which was not at all what her father had told her. He told her I abandoned her and her brother and wanted nothing more to do with them. This is not true. Those kids were my life. Now she can't understand why her father lied to them all these years. I have no idea how to comfort her or even build a relationship after all this time. I gave birth to her brother at 15 and to her at 16. Their father was older and very controlling. We live in two different states, which doesn't help. I have never stopped loving and missing my kids. I have asked multiple people for suggestions, and they have nothing to offer. Any advice would be greatly appreciated. Signed, Reconnecting in Tennessee. Dear Reconnecting, It is wonderful that after all these years, you have finally been able to make a connection with your daughter. Please, take it slowly, one step at a time. She will need to understand how young you were when she and her brother were born, and the imbalance of power in your relationship with their older and controlling father. Your daughter should know that you always wanted her in your life, but that the estrangement was their father's punishment for you. Reinforce that you never stop loving, missing, or thinking about them, and they are part of you. Living in different states may make things more challenging, but you may be able to establish a friendship and visit your daughter in the future. You can contact Dear Abby at www.dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.